Good evening. We're on the very end of this ox trip. We've ridden it all the way to the 10th stage. And it's curious because one would think that, as I've said, it would end up in sort of the ethereal realm or something. And the last three bodies of Buddha, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, you would think it would go the other way around. First you get the Buddha of the embodied Buddha, the practicing on the ground Buddha, and then you would get the sort of ethereal Buddha, and then you would get the whole thing, the Dharmakaya, the body of the many universes. But in fact, it goes the other way around. The insight, and it has to be this way. It's how our mind works. When we see interbeing, experience interbeing, when our mind is no longer a hindrance and we begin to realize that there's a whole nother aspect of our way of being in the world, that's catching the untalkaboutable Dharmakaya. And then following it through with the expression Sambhogakaya, enjoyment of the truth, it says sometimes, the body of delight, of joy. And then this last one, Nirmanakaya, is the embodying of the whole. Entering the marketplace. Entering the marketplace barefoot and unadorned. Blissfully smiling, though covered with dust and ragged of clothes. Using no supernatural power, you bring the withered trees spontaneously into bloom. So, as Dido says, it isn't that you get somewhere and then stop practicing. It isn't that everything becomes fixed once and for all and everything is fine. It's just that on a certain level, the effort, the original effort that we begin with isn't so necessary, perhaps. This is where I don't quite agree with this presentation of it, that and I suppose he says that it's all of a piece, that even though it's divided up into chapters, that they all run together, because it seems to me that that this possessing nothing and clinging to nothing kind of state occurs throughout our life and comes and goes. If we return to beginner's mind, we return from somewhere. And so it's much more of a back and forth than it is coming home for good, you could say. And yet there is a kind of freedom that that develops as we sit. As you know, if you've sat a sesshin, we start up uptight usually and full of a thousand thoughts, concerns, opinions, judgments, understandings, ideas about ourself, especially obsessions about ourself. And as we sit through time, all those things begin to change. And there is a kind of freedom that comes, as he says, a kind of boundless generosity develops, and a deeper understanding of not only one's own life, but of the presence of others and how it is with others. And yet, as he says, it's not, or it's nothing special. I think we have to begin by thinking it's something special, because it keeps us going for a while. But the farther we go with it, the less special it seems. And yet rare at the same time. He uses an interesting phrase. He says, we accomplish ourselves. Which is a bit like what we were talking about last week about saving all sentient beings, that we save the sentient beings of our mind. And our accomplishment is an accomplishment of ourself. So, I don't know what else to say about this, these stages. It's a beautiful metaphor, and it's got illustrations, which is really helpful. We have the picture of the ox and the notion of the ox, and that's very helpful. And there's some koans about the ox. How the ox can get through the window, everything except the tail. How come the tail can't get through? It's supposed to. So, I don't know how you all feel about this. It's been very interesting. And I'm glad we did it. I'm very glad we did it. I think we've learned a lot in the course of it. It's just about time to think about something else, but I'd like to finish this up tonight and then talk about what we do next week. But please put on your hats, your thinking hats. Isn't that what they used to say in school?
We had a list, didn't we?
We already.
Oh, we did decide? Yeah. Oh, what did we decide?
I can't.
Okay. Okay, the Bodhisattva Way of Life. Yes.
That's a specific, that's a book?
Yes, it's a book. We should decide on which translation. There are a lot of them. I'll look into that. Thank you, Wendy. Yes. But what about this one in the meantime? What was your experience of it?
Lately I've been thinking about a very interesting thing. I think when I was a teenager, I can almost remember like the day when I stopped just being a kid and realized that there was something to know. Like there was, I was looking for something. Big question mark. Didn't know what I was looking for, but I was looking for something, some answer. And it kind of, if you take the story of the ox a little too literally, that's what you see. You see someone looking for something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think slowly in the practice of Zazen, you realize that there is nothing, there's no secret answer that makes everything okay, which in some senses what the fallacy was when I was a teenager. It's like, I guess I don't understand, maybe a psychologist would know this, but why would you start looking after you, quote, had the secret of no secret, that there is nothing to look for, when you were a kid, and then suddenly it switches, and then you seem to think you need to find something. But if you let go of the fog of saying, I gotta find what it's all about, and just, you know, when you're typing on the computer, you're typing on the computer, and when you're cutting up vegetables, just cut them up. And don't worry about how does it all fit in, and what's the big mystery, and I guess, you know, the big questions, you know, who's God, what's God, what does it mean to be in society, all these big questions, and just live your life. And don't be deluded by looking for the answer, capital T, capital A. And it seems almost like the answer to the secret that I've been looking for is I shouldn't have gone on the path of looking. I should have let it go. The minute the question came up, I should have dropped it off. It seems like I've been on this path since, you know, 12 or 13, and it's like, wow, it's been a long time. But just let it go.
Well, that's a part of it. There was a time in China when a whole monastery full of monks came to this point, and they all quit and went home. Because it's a partial view. It's bodhicitta that is the question that wakes us up. The sort of the lure of an enlightenment. The lure that there is something that we don't know.
Yes.
And the truth is, there is a way of being in the world and that we haven't awakened to. So it's not about knowing something, it's about waking up to the whole of it. But you're right, we can get hooked into that wanting to know what the answer is. And that's why they have this whole koan practice, because that uses that lust for an answer, which is really what it gets to be when it drives you crazy, to finally see through how the mind is working. But as long as we're self-involved, we're still not finished.
If we finish, don't we die? before?
Well, in a sense, of course, we're finished when we die. We're not even finished when we die, many people believe. So it's an infinite journey. But on the other hand, there are, in the sense of this book, stages, you could say, and or at least insights that we come to. The most basic of which is the most basic of Buddha's teaching of no self. So without that understanding, the whole Dharma that we practice and exercise as best we can is still self-serving in a way. So what I mean by that is just that abandoning that self-serving attitude is a kind of grateful point in our life.
I'm still confused about the finished part. What do you mean by finished?
Well, temporarily finished. Finished for the moment. Yeah.
Things hit you and you understand.
Yes, when you can open your mind wide enough to see how utterly much a part of everything your life is, that your life is a world, and that you yourself, by yourself, are nothing by yourself.
In other words, entering the marketplace.
Yes.
You know, the
yes.
The step eight where you transcend, where the enso is still, you're still on that
yes.
path, and it's not greedy, but it's self-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You recognize that it's empty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And the returning to the source is maybe a bridge,
mm-hmm.
metaphorically.
Yes.
You're saying, where does that emptiness come from?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, if I understand you right, yeah. metaphorically, entering the marketplace says, well, what do you do with that now?
Yes. And the dharmic life, or the bodhisattva life, is a life of action. It's how we actually interlive, I think Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, that we inter-are with everything. So that practice becomes not so much, it is still sitting, but sitting is not the focus. It's how we are in the world. What we can do. We're bodies. You know, these wonderfully clever, intricate bodies that can do so much. So to find activities, actions, redeeming actions, you could say, participatory actions, relationships, as we dance together. You know, from a distance, you can look and see that it's all an enormous dance.
It's the Macarena. The answer was the Macarena.
In terms of like self-absorption, self-involvement, what exactly, what does that consist of? Like, I mean, is it just like acting without any consideration of other people? I mean, is it that which makes us do that, or
yeah,
we get caught on that?
Well, it's caught on the idea of the self in the first place.
That there's something permanent.
That there's something permanent that needs to be protected at all times. And so much of our way of relating to the world is in some kind of way of protecting ourselves.
As if we're not going to die or change or...
And as if we're not connected to everything else. So, you know, we see an enemy where there's just something else that's actually a part of our own life. Everything that's going on is a part of our own life. Everything that we're aware of is us, different versions of us. Jane?
This morning I woke up with a great deal of sadness with the massacre in Virginia. And one thing I've noticed about this practice is that you do feel things more. And I noticed today and yesterday I was talking to two people about it, and it just struck me, here we are, two women in California, and it was two women on two different occasions, here we are in California just like heartbroken talking about this, and that's how this works, you know, that there's the people there to whom it happened. And we all seize on it as we will. What else can we do? And you know, I'm not there in Virginia, and I don't need to be really. We're in relationship with each other, and I think that's what we did. We just stood there with each other and shared.
Yeah. We were those kids, and we were the shooter, too.
I also really understand how I can offer my life without putting extra on that as a prayer of peace, and just kind of hold a prayer and intention that everything I do and think and say is an offering for peace.
Yes.
And it makes sense in a way that doesn't really make very much sense.
Yeah.
Because there isn't a separation.
There's no separation. And it doesn't mean that because we know that we're going to fix everything and nobody's ever going to do a bad thing anymore. It's just that we are the peace itself. As the flow happens through life, our intention is, our bodhisattva intention is the peacefulness itself, wherever we are, in whatever condition. So even in the hell of Abu Ghraib or someplace like that, it's still there. And we feel it more and more, it's true. But we feel the good things too.
This is true too. This is true too.
So that there's a thing called sympathetic joy. And that's when somebody else is happy, we feel happy too. That doesn't just always happen. sometimes we feel jealous or kind of miserable anyway, and what's the matter with that person, or, you know, it's kind of a grumpy thing. But as our heart opens, we begin to feel more and more other people's happiness. If somebody else is happy, it can make us happy too. And that's a really wonderful thing, because it expands it, you know, from a little thing to a much bigger one.
Think of us, me, or, you know, as, like, even in terms of, like, the situation that Jane brought up, like, the shooter. I mean, I guess I see that kind of perspective as a way that it kind of engenders, like, more compassion and not feeling an us versus
yes.
them kind of thing.
Yes.
Is that...
Yes.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that what he did was a good thing.
Or that we
have those characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Except that, you know, if we were as crazy as he is, he was, who knows what we would do? I have a friend who is perfectly normal, except sometimes she goes crazy and runs out in the street with nothing on and screams and yells and just turns into something else completely. And then she's in the hospital for a while, and then she comes out, and then she's fine again. Very smart and lovely woman. So, you know, there are a lot of things we can't account for, and our own minds are not accountable in that way either. We're just very fortunate that we're as sane as we think we are.
I heard this, well, I think I read in Hardcore Zen the notion that all those kinds of thoughts, even though consider them like murderous thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those kind of, I don't know, flow through us as well. It's
yes.
when we identify.
Like, yes.
And also, like, oh, like, as if no one else is thinking the same
mm-hmm.
thought.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of creates this kind of self.
Yes.
That kind of almost, I don't know. You get attached to it and, you know, become more and more identified with it. Whether or not you know something is bad,
yeah.
you become more identified and more prone to act on it. I don't know. Like
that's exactly what the whole self-notion is. Becoming attached to our ideas about who we think we are.
Yeah. That becomes pretty hellish.
Yes, it can be a terrible hell realm. He must have suffered terribly. Kitty?
So, back to the book. I guess my limited understanding about the whole thing is to see if this sounds right or makes sense, but so the ox is representing our mind, and what taming it just means we don't really change it. It's still doing the same stuff.
Yeah.
But you just know what it's doing. And maybe
mm-hmm. you see through it. You don't identify with it.
Maybe you like control it in the sense that you don't get carried away with where it
yes.
ideas and it generates.
Yes.
You just know it's an idea.
Yes.
There'll be another one.
Yeah. And you can appreciate it.
Yeah, because it's temporary.
kind of good to have a mind, huh?
It is indeed.
Not most very often, but
well. Well, you're in school.
Yeah.
You need it.
I find myself like sometimes on a test question, I just like I get attached to something. I just like have this attachment to some idea, and then I don't know, a day later, the teacher explains later, I'm thinking, why did I get stuck on that? It was obvious it was something else.
So yeah.
I just, I don't know.
So yeah.
It is interesting to, you know, you can use this practice to watch your mind in school, too.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that's, does that sound about right?
In the sutra, we say mind is no hindrance. So it's not that the mind goes away. It just doesn't trip us up so much anymore.
And when does that happen?
When practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita.
Okay. Hopefully before your final exam.
Yeah, I better practice that before the test. More work for other people than some people, or is it about all the same? I mean, it seems like it takes so much work. Yeah. And some people are just easygoing, nothing pisses them off, you know, you tell them you don't look very good today, they don't care. Somebody tells me that, or they, you know, or they, the wrong day, I'll start boohooing. So,
I think people have different triggers, different things that upset them, and some people are more what do we say, sanguine than others. But Zazen practice is not about just being okay with everything. It's much more than that. It's actually just what I've been talking about seeing through the self-obsession that creates so many hindrances in human life, in life itself, actually. Life as it lives in the rivers and the creeks and the lakes, life as it lives in the trees and on the ice shelf and, you know, on the earth. So it's about how we live in relationship, not just feeling good ourselves.
So are you saying it affects others and things, and
yes.
So you won't be so selfish that this is about me being okay with things and
yes.
being cool.
Yes.
You know, it's going to help my neighbor. It's going to help people in Africa. It's big.
Exactly. And that's why the little guy, when he comes out into the world, is in rags and bare feet. He's not a fancy person at all. He's just willing to be there for everybody, with everybody.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
He's a bodhisattva.
He's a bodhisattva.
Didn't Coven say that we should fly under radar?
Yes. You said we were guerrilla warriors, meaning, you know, hiding behind the bushes and sneaking through the alleys and meeting in smoky cafes. Or there's the Sufi tradition, you know, of not making a show of practice, that a teacher just shows up as a cobbler, a very modest cobbler, and then students begin to gather around him, and nobody even really knows they exist. They're just practicing. I've always liked that idea a lot. Is it time? Oh, it is. Thank you, Lauren.
There's time for me to ask a question.
Does everybody have time for Lauren's question?
I have a friend who I met in Berkeley many, many years ago. And she was the one I went, she sort of invited me to go along with her to Green Gulch. Sort of her first experience with meditation. And I forget who was doing the Zazen instruction that day, but she kind of liked that teacher. And, I've mentioned this before. Some days I can remember her name, and some days I can't. But so this friend moved back into Berkeley a few years ago, and I went to visit her. She's adopted a young daughter, and we went to the park together. And so in the park we went to, there was a climbing structure on which there were some rather rude young boys. And because of these rude young boys on the climbing structure, her daughter couldn't climb on the climbing structure. Her daughter was sort of younger and frailer than they were. Now, my approach, my feeling was that, you know, there simply wasn't much to be done. It was sort of, I took a whose problem is it approach. And that kind of didn't suit my friend. My friend, I think, felt that it was necessary to say something to these young boys. And I don't exactly remember what happened. I think she said something to them, and they might not have received it with as much attention as she wanted them to. But she sent me an email afterwards. I think the essence of the email was, you don't understand this interbeing thing at all. Well, that's kind of my question. My question, because when you mentioned it, my thought was that if I had understood this interbeing thing, I conceivably would have known exactly the right thing to say to these young boys. But
did she want you to say something? You should have told her that. You didn't ask me to say anything.
Who knows? I mean, this is, you know, it's partly, you know, my conception of being, you know, I'm the man there and these are young boys, and so it's my role to say something to them if anybody says something to them. And it's conceivable they would have been more amenable to hearing something from a man than from a mother. Anyway, what do you make of
that? Well, does interbeing mean controlling others?
She was using it in whatever sense Thich Nhat Hanh uses it. I mean, she was knowledgeable as far as that goes.
Well, do you know the story of Thich Nhat Hanh when the riots broke out in Los Angeles because the police beat up a truck driver or something like that?
Rodney King,
yeah. It was the Rodney King thing. And Thich Nhat Hanh was doing a retreat here in Watsonville. And a friend of mine was there. And she said that when he heard about that, he was furious with the police, just horrified by the whole thing blowing up the way it was. And people, oh, it was terrible. And he worked with it for a whole week before he came to the point of being able to identify with the police as well as Rodney King. And he did it with, not with everyone, but he kept everyone informed about his process, his suffering. He suffered with it, trying to feel his way, like identifying with the shooter. And finally, he said he realized what a terrible life the police in Los Angeles had, especially in the ghettos, and how scary, how terrifying it must be all the time. And he finally got to the point of being able to feel for them. But it wasn't like that. And he's the expert. So you can tell your friend, you didn't have enough time. And that is an effort, you know. It isn't easy.
What have I learned enough since then?
Who knows? Who knows?
There are other things your kid can play with till those kids went away. They weren't going to be there forever. I mean, it's a park. And I feel like she's putting on too much responsibility. How often do you see her? Or is this something that they did? It all depends how important that was. I mean, did that kid plan all day on playing on those things, or was there anything she could have done till, you know, those kids were gone? You know, sometimes I think our friends just, because they know they care about us, they just put the blame on us. She probably doesn't need to do that. But,
Well, okay. Thank you for defending.
We love you, Lauren.
You do that without knowing.
The wondrous threads have intervened.
Yes.
She might not have known what to say to these, you know, 5-year-olds either. And yet, you know, we have a lot of stories about the Buddha in which he manages to say what seems to be amazingly just the right thing.
Yeah. How many times has the story been revised?
Oh, of course.
We'll carry a gun with you next time. There you go, honey.
That kind of reminds me of Coven.
With the knife.
With Wizard.
Yes. Yes.
Wizard?
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's the story of Coben and the knife. You know that? Yeah. Yeah. So, skillful means. And just giving up the project. You know, you don't have to pursue it, as you say. You know. That's skillful too. You know, be my guest. As Coben has said, if two people are trying to get through the same door, you can let the other person go first. You're not going to lose anything that way. It's not a big deal. But we do tend to want to get there. Thank you, Lauren. That was great.